Good morning. I think we are ready to hear the next case on our calendar today. But before we do so, based on the briefs, both HGW and SLG appealed in this matter. I see counsel for SLG, but not HWG.
Your Honor, I didn't anticipate that the father was asking for oral argument or participating today. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for that clarification. That's helpful. All right, well, with that then, I think we are ready to proceed. The next case on our calendar today is A23-1140 and A23-1143. In the matter of the welfare of the children of SLG and HWG. Each party will have 15 minutes for your argument, and appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. We are recording the oral argument here today, and I'll just remind anyone who may be viewing online that no other recordings are permitted except with the express prior permission of the Minnesota Court of Appeals. So with that, counsel for appellant SLG, you can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, may it please the court. My name is Ann Morris Carlson. I represent appellant mother SLG. Mere poverty is seldom, if ever, a sufficient basis to deprive one of their natural right to parent their child, to say nothing of their statutory right. Klugman, 1959. I'm asking a lot of things of this court, and here's the order of my list that it's in. I'm asking that this court would find that in charging child support rendered the efforts to reunify the family unreasonable. This family had its children taken away largely due to its state of being impoverished. Agency failed to pass its requirement under 260C.331. It instead argues that I do not have standing. My challenge is to the efforts, not specifically the child support, but I believe that if you have a family with an income of $2,000, and the main thing that is preventing them from having the children return to their care is that they cannot afford adequate housing for a family of seven, that you have rendered your efforts unreasonable by taking half their income from them while they struggle to find housing for 2 years, ultimately finding housing with the assistance of an agency that they located in Dakota County with the assistance of their arms worker. So that is my number one ask. After that, I am asking the court to find, if the court declines to find that that renders the efforts unreasonable, then I'm asking the court to find that what renders the efforts unreasonable is that the agency failed to assist these parents in becoming trauma-informed. The agency changed argument was that the parents didn't have adequate housing. Once the parents had adequate housing, suddenly the agency became wrapped up in whether or not the parents could meet the mental health needs of the children. The agency made no efforts to assist these parents in becoming equipped to address their children's mental health needs.
Ms. Carlson, the sound is a little bit delayed for me with your transmission. I don't know if it's on my end or not, but I'm hearing you. It's just like there's sort of a delay, but be that as it may. I want to ask you about this because you clearly argue in your brief that it's basically we should be relying solely on the plain language in the CHIPS petition, which did focus on the housing conditions and the need to improve those. But As has been noted by respondent, and I believe the court too in its order, of course, this is sort of a dynamic thing. I mean, that was one concern of the county, but you do not deny that the children had or have mental health issues, do you?
By no means. No, the children, of course, they've been in five different foster settings. Sure. They absolutely should have. It would surprise me. There's a lot of things in this order that concern me, and a lot of them that I think could have been and should have been differently handled. One of the concerns in the order that comes up to me is why is it a safe concern that the parent time in therapy talking about the fact that they are upset that their children are not in their care? One would hope. One would have the greatest issue facing parents that their five children are bouncing around among five different foster homes and that they're struggling to make ends meet. Your Honor, I'm sorry. I apologize if there's a delay. It is telling me my internet connection is unstable, which is something that, of course, would only happen this morning.
Sure. No, I can hear you.
I do not struggle with that. So
I think the panel can too.
If the court would let me know what issues it has in hearing me, I'm happy to clarify anything that gets missed.
Well, let me just say, I appreciate your passion, but would you not agree that as, family circumstances evolve and more information is gained by the county, that there's a reason to then adapt to other circumstances that need to be addressed by parents?
I think I stated in my argument that what needs to happen here is then you need to change your efforts. Yes, of course. Of course. Of course, if you enter the home and you find out that the children are unsafe due to the state of the home, and further working with the family indicates to you that there are other safety concerns, then you absolutely can and should attempt to remedy those safety concerns. I'm not saying that the agency should look the other way. However, once you recognize that the safety concern is that the children's mental health needs are in jeopardy of not being met, you with the parents to help them figure it out. And in this record is that the parents didn't even know what their children were diagnosed with until their child's therapist was testifying at the trial. Now, I understand faulting that therapist. This is operating under her counsel's direction to not share information about the children. But if this was true, where the agency was exercising diligence to do all things possible to reunify the family, then it is inexcusable that the social worker failed to ever bridge the gap. The social worker was required to work with the parents to assist them in becoming able to meet their children's needs.
Just following up on that, did the parent ever, does the record reflect that the parent asked the social worker for assistance in talking with the children's therapist to find out more about their mental health needs?
Concern of mine is that it wasn't addressed by the case plan that other than here are some services that are located 2 hours away from you. We're going to hold it against you first that only one of you has a driver's license and that it's a struggle to get to these services that may get canceled due to the global pandemic. But when you are enlisted in the services, we aren't going to give you more time to complete those services because the timelines are up. My concern here is that they weren't informed that the reason that the children couldn't be returned to their care was due to the mental health needs of the children. In fact, the court's order indicates that the reason it got continued is because the parents were on the verge of obtaining housing, which was the overarching concern throughout the duration of the CHIPS case. Now, I recognize there are some other concerns. Father arguably could have benefited from some insight, and his insight was not well demonstrated, but a parent's relationship with the child protection services is not indicative of their inability to care for their children. It's not indicative of a condition related to the parent-child relationship that father maybe could have been more agreeable with social services than he was. This record indicates that mother was asking for assistance. And she was acceptable to it. She was amenable to it. And she took the assistance that was asked. In the ways that she was asked to comply with her case plan and the ways that was directed to her, she did. She was agreeable to getting the children to services. And when we look at these children's mental health needs, my impression is that the need is that they continue ongoing therapy. It frustrates me that the outcome could have been ongoing services and should have probably ongoing services. This is a case where I think ongoing services, probably until child five reaches the age of 18, would have been a more appropriate outcome, because the agency relies on the fact that the children want someone in the home. Well, I recognize it's not feasible to have 24-hour assistance, and I don't think that 24-hour assistance is needed to correct or to ensure the conditions that led to removal are corrected. If the conditions that led to removal, recognizing that there can be other things that give the agency concern, but if the conditions that led to removal were the state of the home, and those were the conditions that led to removal, then it would seem that weekly checking in on the home would alleviate the safety concern. If the concern is that the children's mental health needs are not being met, then it would seem ongoing case management assistance in the form of ensuring that the children make it to therapy, something the agency could easily take on, would be the way of ensuring that these children stay in the home.
Ms. Carlson, I recognize you're not representing the father here, and we don't have a voice for him apparently today, but you say he lacked insight. I mean, I think that's a real understatement. He went through anger management class, completed it, but that, as noted in the record, doesn't seem to have really made a difference in the way that he handled situations within the house. And it does seem well documented that the children, at least some of them, were afraid of him. And that's why the last effort to get the children back home seemed to fail, is at least a partial basis for that. What is your response to that?
I think that the reason that it failed is because the parents probably were not supportive of, I won't speculate. The court is correct that at the time of the termination trial, the concern was that there were children that did not feel that their emotional needs were being met by the father. Mm-hmm. We're having two parents of care, custody, and control of their children. And I think that ongoing assistance to mother was required. It is presumed to be in the children's best interests that they be returned to the care of their parents. And this is a case where it ends with, I mean, I'm asking this court that it not end here with the children in separate foster homes, because the agency didn't identify this particular safety concern until the time it was contemplating initiating a trial home visit. Mother did what she needed to do. Perhaps a concern, maybe to the court's point, would have been that mother needed to situate herself away from father, but I won't speculate about facts that aren't in front of the court. Mm-hmm. I'll say that she complied with her case plan fully. And to be clear, my asks, I want reversal on the basis that there were no reasonable efforts. I want a finding that the collection of child support without the required assessment of whether the collection of child support would impact a parent's ability to comply with their case plan renders the efforts unreasonable. But if this court does not find that argument persuasive, I'm asking that this court would find that the efforts are unreasonable because they failed to conform to the presenting problem. The assistance that was given to the agency by the agency to the parents was not adequate to address the agency and the court's stated concern that the parents were not trauma informed, which falls far short of a statutory basis or a current safety condition that would prevent the children from being returned to their care.
Let me ask you this question. Is it legally appropriate for any consideration to be given to the long history that this family has had and their struggles? I mean, they seem to have, if you look at the patterns over time, remedied the circumstances in their home for a relatively short period of time, and then things deteriorate again. And so it's been kind of this pattern in this cycle. Is that appropriate to take into consideration?
When you talk about a long history of child protection involvement, what you're talking about is a long history of being poor.
Well, I understand that.
But the issue is poverty. The issue is poverty. I can't read this 108-page order and not see the court reference the financial situation of the family on. I couldn't count. I lost track because the court continually hammers the fact that there's an ongoing history of working with this family. What I'm seeing in looking at this 12-year history is that at one point in time, there were no driver's licenses and now there is one. At one point in time, there was no financial stability and now dad has a job. This family is marginal. These parents are marginal, but they have moved forward through this 12-year history so that abuse of the children is not a current concern. Whether or not father is trauma-informed, okay, more services are needed. More services are needed for this family, but its history is not a current safety condition that justifies a termination of parental rights, depriving the parents of care, custody, and control, which they are entitled to, and it is presumed to be in the children's best interests. If I may finish a very quick,
interject, I'm sorry, Judge Cochran, I have a couple of questions I'd like to ask before we run out of time, if I may do that now, maybe before counsel sums up.
Sure, go ahead.
Ms. Carlson, I have questions about the withholding of money, the $1,000 per month. I'm unclear about the procedural history. Did the district court approve that pretrial at the county's request? Is that something, or did the district court consider that issue for the first time in the order? I'm looking at page 72 where it's discussed.
Your Honor, the reason I felt that I was able to address that is because the district court addressed it in its order, but in my review of the record, which I admit is limited. It's limited to these proceedings and limited to the closing arguments made by both the parents as well as I don't have a way of answering that off the top of my head.
Okay,
what I know is that both parents addressed the order for support as being something that was damaging towards their ability to comply with their out-of-home placement plan. And it appears on its face that it obviously was hampering their ability to locate housing.
Perhaps I'll come back.
I also, later. Your Honor, sorry. I also have been, 260C.331 is not something that comes up in my practice, which is exclusively child protection defense, enough that I've ruminated over it prior to this case. But my understanding is that that is a requirement on the agency to assess whether or not the collection of child support would render the parents unable to meet the needs of the out-of-home placement plan and whether or not the collection of child support would impact a parent's ability to have the children returned to their care and the parent's ability to safely care for the children once that return happens. Thank you.
Thank you.
Was there another question? Your Honor, I'm asking for finding that there was no reasonable efforts, finding that the collection of child support in and of itself renders efforts unreasonable. If not that, finding that the efforts failed to conform to the presenting problem. If not that, I'm asking that this court would find that there is not a statutory basis to terminate these parents' parental rights. And if not that, the district court failed to make best interest determinations that can be adequately reviewed by this court. It failed to include a balancing test. That itself requires remand. For those reasons, I'm asking that this court would reverse and remand the district court's order terminating the parental rights of SLG and HWG. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And I not exactly sure what is going on here, but I received a chat. Just so the record's clear, I received a chat in the box from an iPhone. I don't know how that person was able to chat with me directly, but it says it's Herman Garrison, and he would like to be involved in these proceedings, and he's been trying to contact John, the attorney, and he hasn't responded to numerous attempts. But given that Mr. Garrison is not an attorney under rules, he's not able to present oral argument. We will proceed with argument from counsel unless Judge Johnson or Judge Hallbrooks wants to add anything at this point.
Nothing for me, Judge Cochran.
Okay, thank you. So counsel for respondent, you can proceed when you're ready. Please identify yourself and the party you represent. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. Counsel, my name is Angela Free. I'm an assistant Crow Wing County attorney. I represent the appellant in this matter. Today, the appellant's request is for the court to affirm the district court's decision to terminate the parental rights of SLG and HW. The district court order addressed the statutory criteria with specific, detailed, and extensive findings. Those findings were supported by the substantial weight of the evidence in the record. Appellants seek to make this case about housing and poverty, but it should be noted importantly that when the family got their house at the end of November and then into December of 2023, the court did continue the trial that was scheduled around that time to allow the family to have the opportunity to fully reunify with their children. In addition, when the children were originally removed from this family in December of, they were placed back within the home within about a week of original removal. And they stayed in out of home, they stayed in the parents' care for approximately 2 months until things went downhill again. But the concerns for the family persisted as outlined through the extensive records. Today, my intention is to start with the issue of reasonable efforts, to move to the statutory grounds, and then finally address the best interests. The reasonable efforts provided by the county in this case were absolutely reasonable. They were extensive, they were varied, and they persisted over 2.5 years that this case was open. The findings detail the historical efforts made by numerous counties with this family in findings of fact 35 through 51, 81, 87, and 89. Those findings are further supported by the testimony of both parents and by Ms. Johnson, and they're supported by the numerous exhibits that were contained in the record. As to the current case, findings of fact 265 list at least 36 efforts made by the agency and supported by the testimony and the exhibits contained in the record, demonstrating the extensive efforts provided during the course of this case. Perhaps one of the most pivotal efforts the agency made was the hiring of Parenting Plus to work with the family in the home to try and set the family up for success. And ultimately, the goal of Parenting Plus was to reunify the family. Throughout the testimony in the record, Parenting Plus was not only created to help the family structure their home, but it also was brought in to provide therapeutic family support to the family. And that's evidenced by the testimony of Ms. Freudel herself at the April 14th transcript. It's page 719, where she talks about the family therapy support that she was brought in to start in December of 2022. And on that note, there were some questions, it's been brought into question whether the agency adequately provided efforts to the parents to become trauma-informed and to address their children's mental health needs. early on in the case, there was a referral made to LA Mental Health Services, who is the family service provider providing therapy to the oldest four children in this case. That family service provider had a parenting education component that was a trauma-informed parenting education and component, and the parents were referred to that. I believe it was in October of 2021 that they were referred. May have been 2020. Sorry, getting my dates confused. However, Ms. SLG in particular, the mother, did make some attempts to participate in that program, ultimately missed enough sessions that the therapist terminated her from that program. Throughout the case, Ms. Johnson, the social worker, made efforts to attempt to connect the family back with Ellie Family Services, but unfortunately, Ellie was not willing to take them back due to the missed appointments that had occurred. So that was kind of the initial efforts that were made. Then the agency brought in FITS in July of 2021. That was a parenting or a supervised parenting program that also provided some parenting education to the family. The family did visits there from April of 2021 to July of 2021. The family then moved to FamilyWise in August of 2021. FamilyWise provided therapeutic parenting. It was a therapeutic parenting program. It was designed to help them address parenting skills from a trauma-informed lens with regard to their children. The family participated in visits there starting in August of 2021. And then as the court's order details, and I won't go through all the facts, there was some back and forth in visits after that, going from supervised to unsupervised, changing between community settings and various other settings. Ultimately, then in December of 2022 is when the agency brought in Parenting Plus. And Ms. Freudel was the provider for the family at FamilyWise. When they finished their time at FamilyWise, she had said if the children get close to reunification, that she'd be willing to work with the family. And so the agency reached out to her in December of 2022 and brought her in to provide those therapeutic services. Unfortunately, those therapeutic services were not successful. As the court has already noted, and as I believe is detailed extensively in my brief. So it would be the county's position that although it's unfortunate that the parents don't have the paper records in their hands stating what their children's specific diagnoses are, that those records in and of themselves would not have made the parents able to parent their children. It was the actual on-the-ground services that were designed to make the difference for the family. And ultimately, they just didn't get there.
Ms. Free, I want to turn to what I think is appellant mother's primary argument about reasonable efforts, and that's the withholding or taking away of $1,000 per month. I have some questions about how that occurred. Was that approved by the court before trial during either the CHIPS phase or the while the termination petition was pending? Or on the other hand, was it a unilateral action by the county?
Your Honor, it was an action by the county. The family was referred for child support collection, and it went through the typical child support channel. It did not come through the district court in the child protection case. So there was a separate proceeding. I believe there are exhibits in the record indicating the summons and the petition for that proceeding that occurred in district court here in Crow Wing County. Father was personally served with the notice. He failed to appear at the hearing and it went by default ultimately.
Do you agree that section 260C.331 applies? Appellant cited it. You did not cite that statute. I'm wondering if you agree that statute applies.
Your Honor, and I think I had relied primarily on the standing issue with regard to with regard to the child support piece as it relates to the mother in this matter.
Well, let me just interrupt you by saying, just for the sake of time, I do not accept your argument that mother does not have standing to challenge reasonable efforts. If this is relevant to reasonable efforts, and that is perhaps debatable, but it seems to me that she's permitted to make the argument that reasonable efforts were undermined by the counties taking away half of their income. I want to probe that further.
Yes, Your Honor. With regard to the cost of care, the agency would need financial information from the parents to really make a full picture decision of whether it was appropriate or not to modify the child support, or in this case, request a modification of child support, because it would have had to go through the district court matter. And the agency was willing to do that.
Let me go back to my question. Do you agree that 260C331 applies?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And part of that, in subdivision 1B, it says that the agency shall consider whether requiring reimbursement would compromise the party's ability to meet the requirements of a plan, meet the child's needs, and so on. Where is that reflected in the record? Whether the agency's consideration of those factors?
Your Honor, I don't believe that point was a point specifically discussed and brought about and elicited during testimony at trial. The issue of child support at trial was while it was an argument advanced by the parties, it was not an issue substantially litigated in the course of the trial. And in part, that's because it was handled through the district court matter. What I do want to indicate, partially to answer your question, is that the agency did attempt to obtain financial information from the parents so that they could assess whether the costs of placement were reasonable or not. And the father in the case refused to provide any information to the agency on numerous bases, and that is reflected in the transcripts.
This statute that has been cited, it allows for reimbursement of the cost. I'm trying to find it now in the statute. I believe it's the cost of care, examination, or treatment. And I believe it's confined to physical or mental examinations or treatment. I mean, did the county take care to ensure that the amounts withheld or were directly related to the costs that are authorized by this statute?
Your Honor, I guess my understanding is that the reason the county went through the child support process was that it was a child support payment and not a reimbursement payment for costs of care. And that's the best answer that I have to that issue.
Okay, thank you.
Aside from the issue of child support, one of the things that is important to keep in mind is that the child support piece of this is just one of the many complicated dynamics that were part of this case. The father in this matter failed to do anything regarding that child support establishment proceeding. As I said, he didn't appear. He didn't make a motion to modify. He didn't provide financial information when requested by the agency, stating that it was his privacy and he felt that he shouldn't have to do that. I also think an assumption is being made that the finances were the only reason the family could not obtain housing. The agency was on a regular basis, probably weekly, if not more, having conversations with this family about housing. And a lot of that conversation, as Ms. Johnson's testimony and the mother's testimony indicates, was surrounding looking for a specific type of housing. So I don't think the record has substantial information to indicate that the finances were the only thing that prevented them from housing. Ms. Johnson made reasonable efforts with regard to housing. She maintained As I said, multiple conversations with the parents and the attorneys. She maintained close contact with the agency that eventually was able to help the family secure housing. She provided letters to that agency and had offered to previously provide letters to other landlords and agencies. She offered to call landlords and advocate for the family.
Counsel, turning specifically to the statutory factors that the district court considered and the factor under subdivision 1B2, I think in considering that factor, the district court looked at the history the party's long history here. Was it going back to Judge Hallbrook's question, which I think is a really good question, was it legally appropriate for the district court to consider that history in its analysis?
I believe that it was, Your Honor. On page 26 of my brief, I cited a case in the matter of the welfare of J.D.L., which is at 522 Northwest 2nd, 364. And that is a case which states that a district court may consider past patterns of behavior in determining whether those patterns are likely to continue in the future. So it's not that the termination can be based on the history itself, but the history can inform the analysis of the current case. And I believe that that's what the court appropriately did here. I also wanted to, the beginning of...
Excuse me, I'm having mute issues with my space bar. It appears your time has expired. I just want to check and see if there's any further questions from the panel. No, okay, then Ms. Free, can you briefly sum up, please?
Yes, Your Honors. It is the respondent's request, Your Honor, that the court affirm the district court order. The decision to terminate the parental rights of SLG and HWG was made with an extensive court order after an extensive record and included detailed and specific findings. The findings identify matters beyond simply poverty and simply housing, but also the mental health needs of the children, which ultimately were the primary reason that the court found was preventing the children from returning home and was grounds for termination at this time. I would ask that the court affirm the order. Thank you.
Thank you. Any rebuttal, Ms. Carlson?
Thank you, Your Honor. For the record, Anne Morris Carlson, representing appellant mother SLG. The command of reasonable efforts is entirely constructive, aimed at saving the save up among parents who are struggling for their children. In re 583 Northwest 2nd, 720 at 723, Minnesota Court of Appeals, 1999. In this case, and defeated its purpose. There needs to be a condition that is permanently detrimental to the children's interests at the time of the termination to justify a statutory basis, okay? And that condition cannot be the parent's inability to perfectly balance their attention between five competing children's. This is very troubling to me, and especially the findings about the visitation. That the parents couldn't evenly divide their attention between five children, the standard is grave and weighty. And the agency is looking for perfect parenting. It claims that that's not the standard, but when you talk about the parents' inability to meet the trauma-informed needs of the children without giving the parents any assistance in knowing what their children's mental health needs are. And I'm not talking about handing them paper, which I think also would have been deficient. I think handing over the therapy records also would not have met the ask of reasonable efforts, entirely constructive, aimed at saving the savable. I think that what had to happen is that the agency needed to come up with a plan, change the case plan, meet with the parents and the therapist, make clear to the therapist that the patient is reunification. Explain to the parents how the children's mental health needs could be met. Most of the court's findings are that they fall far short of the legal standard that return of the children to the parents would be permanently detrimental to the children's welfare. And where a court fails to make findings regarding the children's best interests, I'm asking this court to reverse on several grounds. I'm asking first that you would reverse based on the fact that the collection of child support rendered the efforts unreasonable. Second, on the basis that the agency failed to make efforts that conform with the
I'd like to stop you there, Ms. Carlson. So on that first issue about the financial issue, do you have any rebuttal to what Ms. Free said in response to my questions?
Ms. Free is not addressing the court's question with regard to whether or not the statute applies. So she declined to address that question when I brought it up in briefing, hiding behind the fact that I don't have standing, apparently. And now she's declining to address that argument when the court makes it here. 260C.331, the court has to, rather, the response social service agency shall consider whether requiring reimbursement would compromise the parent's ability to meet the requirements of the reunification plan. The reunification plan was that the parents would become financially able to care for the children.
One of my questions has to do
with that at the time the district court makes the decision to require payments from the parent to the agency. In other words,
I'm sorry, Your Honor, just some clarification on your question. I'm too late to this argument. I mean, have to acknowledge that I got appointed on the appeal.
Yeah, and I recognize
I'm disadvantaged. I was not representing the parents at the district court level. So coming into this, I see it as, they started collecting child support in May of 2021, 2 months after adjudication. That's not reasonable. Then they complained that the parents didn't comply with the budgeting program. And the court makes several findings about the financial situation. One of the parents is employed full time. Great. We're well situated here. If you weren't taking half their income and then asking them to find housing for a family of seven. I'm sorry.
So I was going to ask about, what would have happened differently if they had had more money, if they'd had their full income. In other words, was there a point in time, does the evidence show that there was a point in time where they wanted to take a particular action with respect to housing, say, or any other salient issue, but they were not allowed to do so because of a lack of funds? I'm just wondering whether that fact or that limitation on their finances appears specifically in the record in that way. I guess what I'm asking is, would it have made a difference? And of course, I understand having $1,000 more per month would make a lot of differences. But I guess what I'm asking is, if I can know specifically what might have changed with respect to housing.
If I can point to some place in the record that would say that had the parents had that additional $1,000 a month, Your Honor, I'm going to have to rely on the fact that the agency shall consider whether requiring reimbursement would compromise the parents' ability to meet the requirements of the reunification plan. I don't think you can prove. Just a moment to gather my sentence here. It cannot rationally be argued that the charging $1,000 a month, $12,000 a year, off an income of $24,000 a year, did not compromise the parents' ability to provide safe, suitable housing, which was the number one overarching safety concern. The efforts are rendered unreasonable by the collection of child support and the agency's failure to consider whether the collection of child support would impact the parents' ability to meet the needs of the safety plan or the out-of-home placement plan was unreasonable. I respectfully request this court would reverse the district court's order.
I have one more follow-up question.
Judge Johnson, you had another question.
Judge
I'm
Cochran
sorry.
Will allow, and that is during the time that child support, as it's been referred to here, during the time that it was being withheld, or were the parties living separately at all times when it was being withheld, or were they sharing a home?
My understanding is that the family relocated to the Twin Cities. They left the Brainerd area in March of 2021, and to alleviate their temporary homelessness, they lived with mother's father, who is an unsafe person for the children to be around. During that time, the record reflects that mother struggled extensively to locate adequate housing for her family of seven. And throughout that time, father acted as the breadwinner. He made the money. Mother looked for the housing.
Judge Cochran.
Are there any other questions?
Judge Cochran, I do have one final question, if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
Okay. So, Ms. Carlson, just back again to this $1,000 child support payment monthly. Clearly that has struck you reading this record in preparation for the appeal in a very strong way. And I can look back myself, but I don't remember this being presented this way to the district court. Can you comment on that at all with your knowledge of the record?
Your Honor, both parents addressed the fact that the collection of child support impacted the ability to obtain and maintain safe, suitable housing in their closing arguments. And the child support orders were presented at the district court. I believe that I have probably expanded on the arguments that were made by trial counsel, as trial counsel both referenced concerns about the collection of child support without, based on my read of the record, necessarily citing to 260C.331. My read of 260C.331 is that the court had, rather the agency, prior to the collection of child support, had to consider whether it impacted the parent's ability to comply with the case plan.
And I appreciate that. What I'm concerned about is whether or not the district court had a true opportunity to factor this into its decision.
The court found that the parents' arguments about child support were without merit. So the court weighed in on it. It wasn't as though the court didn't address the arguments about child support. Whether or not it was brought to the court's attention that the agency, I defer to this court.
Okay, thank you very much.
No further questions then? All right.
Thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you to both counsel for your arguments here today and for answering our questions. We will consider the matter within the statute and issue our opinion within the statutory timeframe, which you know is an expedited timeframe. So thank you.
Thank you.